This is Foster McCurley from the Wrestling with the Word podcast, and this is our discussion of the Bible text for October 17, 2010. This is episode 95. The passages we will discuss here are those listed in the Revised Common Lectionary for Lectionary 29, the 21st Sunday after Pentecost, Year C. Check out the show notes on the lessons at wrestlingwiththeword.com. You will find there some comments on the Hebrew and Greek words that are important in the passages, as well as cross-references to other biblical texts that help illumine the ones we are studying. The biblical passages for Lectionary 29, the 21st Sunday after Pentecost, Year C, are these. The psalm is number 121. The first lesson is Genesis 32, verses 22 through 31. The second lesson is 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 14 through chapter 4, verse 5. The gospel for the day is Luke 18, verses 1 through 8. The title for this series of podcasts is Wrestling with the Word. Thanks to Google Alerts, I have learned that the expression occurs in many conversations regarding just about any issue in the world. In this series, however, the Word is specifically God's Word. Here we wrestle with biblical texts as God speaks through inspired witnesses of biblical times about the intimate involvement of God in creation and in history. Those whose writings came down to us wrestled, as we do, to determine how God comforts us and accuses us as we live out our lives in God's world. In the face of the challenges in their day, the biblical writers announced God's identity and grace, God's hiddenness and judgment, God's will and action, God's pleasure and displeasure. To accomplish their proclamation, the ancient writers wrestled, as we do, with nothing and no one less than God. While we do not have the opportunity that Jacob had to wrestle with God at a river, God does invite us to a wrestling match. It happens in our prayers, where God challenges us and enables us to trust and to stand firm against all the odds. Let's begin then with the psalm for the day, which is number 121. While the original purpose of this psalm is not really certain, its beauty and comforting expressions give it a place of favor among devout people of all times. The first verses introduce the psalm as a dialogue. Verse 1 comes from the lips of a person about to begin a journey, it seems. The speaker looks to the mountains ahead, awesome to behold, yet full of potential danger. This imminent journey across and through the mountain heights causes the worshiper to ask about the source of help or strength along the way. From where will my help come? Unlike an answer to a similar question regarding wisdom in Job 28, which appears a couple of times, there is a response here that's simply other than who knows. The response here provides the traveler hope and promise. It says, help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. Unlike the answer to a similar question regarding where does wisdom come from in Job 28 a couple of times, there is a response here. It isn't simply, as in Job 28, who knows. The response here provides the traveler hope and promise. Help comes from the Lord. In fact, the one who made the heaven and the earth. There is a remarkable statement in itself. The God of creation is the one who is going to accompany the traveler on this journey. It's hard to know who speaks that answer. It's either the worshiper himself, who is indeed saying, my help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth, or it's a priest saying, help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Now, the journey itself is often assumed to flow from the lips of a priest. Now, whoever does indeed speak that answer, either the worshiper or a priest, the following verses 3 through 6 appear to flow from the lips of a priest. The journey itself is often assumed, therefore, to be the homeward trip from the temple in Jerusalem following a pilgrim's required visit. It's also possible that the setting takes place outside the home of the pilgrims as they set out for the temple. In that case, the answer might come from a Levite because the priests would have been assigned to Jerusalem itself. In any case, the Lord, who will be the help, will remain constantly alert to keep the traveler from harm, according to verses 3 through 4. Yahweh will protect and guard the pilgrim, even from the blistering sun during the day and the mysterious moon at night. That's verses 5 to 6. Even beyond the immediate journey, however, the Lord will maintain such diligence over the worshipper's life in every place and at all times. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time on and forevermore. Our first lesson is Genesis 32, verses 22 through 31. This is one of the more bizarre stories in the Bible, but it has some profound significance that it's worth a lot of discussion. I'll try to limit myself here to just get at the main points of the story's meaning. I summarize the story like this. As Jacob returns home to meet his brother Esau, God wrestles him and changes him to equip him for the reunion. Now, the bizarre story is simply this. Jacob was on his way home to see his brother Esau, and he was afraid of that encounter, so he got up in the night and took his two wives, his two maids, his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He sent them across the stream, and everything that he had, and he had a considerable amount. So Jacob was left alone, and they were told this, a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now when daybreak was about to occur, when the sun was about to rise, and this man did not prevail against Jacob, he whacked him somehow in the hip, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint. And then the man said, let me go, for the day is breaking. It's kind of like a vampire who has to disappear before the sun shines. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Unless you bless me. The arrogance of this guy. So the man said to him, what is your name? And Jacob said, oh, it's Jacob. Yaakov. And then the man said, you shall no longer be called Yaakov, Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. Now that's an astonishing thing, that all we're told until this very point is that it's a man who came to wrestle with Jacob. And now, when the man is about to change Jacob's name to Israel, the explanation is that he has just spent the night wrestling with God and has prevailed. And so Jacob asked him, well, okay then, what's your name? And the man, whom we now know as God, or an angel of God, an expression of God, just passed off the question and blessed him. He actually did what Jacob had asked. I won't let you go until you bless me. So now the man, or God, blesses Jacob. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, face of God, for he said, I've seen God face to face, yet my life is preserved. So the sun rose upon him as he went limping away because of his hip. Now, it is really a bizarre story. It's one of these stories that really originated around campfires. Had something to do with crossing a river and having to fight off the river demon before making a successful crossing. Something like a Billy Goat's Gruff story. And then all of a sudden it becomes a theological story where the one to be wrestled, in fact, the one who does the wrestling, is God. Now, that's about as bizarre as a story can be, but it does show that over the course of many, many campfires, and perhaps even many centuries, the story has taken on different forms and comes out the way we have it right now. I ask you to check the show notes for some of the details and the cross-references to a number of points in the story that I think are particularly significant. But the story does call us to focus on the change of the name. This wrestler, this nocturnal wrestler, who is actually God, changes Jacob's name to Israel. Now, what has been the meaning of Jacob's name? Why was he called Jacob in the first place? Well, back at the birth of Jacob and Esau, the twins born to Isaac and Rebekah, Esau came out first. As the firstborn, that meant that he would be receiving the prime share of the inheritance, get all the blessings and rights and privileges due to the firstborn. But Jacob was trying so hard not to let that happen for Esau, and he grabbed his heel. He wanted out first. He was like dragging him back. You get back here. I'm first. But Esau did emerge first. And because Jacob grabbed his heel, the narrator tells us that's why he's called Jacob, because the Hebrew word for heel is Akev. Jacob, Yaakov, Akev. That's why he's called heel. Well, it doesn't make any sense, but most of these etymologies about names, most of these explanations of why this or that person is called what he or she is because of a popular etymology. They didn't worry about grammar or even about what word actually is the background. They just went on the basis of what words sound like. Now, there's still another explanation for why Jacob is called Yaakov. And this occurs after the second time that Jacob cheated his brother. The first time, you'll recall, was essentially buying his brother's birthright for nothing more than a bowl of soup. And the second one was when he dressed like his brother, made his arms woolly so he'd appear like hairy Esau, and received, therefore, the firstborn's blessing from their father Isaac. When that occurred, Esau said to him, "You are rightly named Yaakov, Jacob, because you've cheated me two times." So now Jacob's name is not connected to the anatomical part called heel. Now it's connected to a verb that means cheat. And if you simply translated Yaakov, it would come out as he cheats, if that were the explanation. But again, that's probably not really what the name means. It probably had something to do with a name like Yaakov El, may God protect. However, that's not in the story, and we're going to go with the story. So this man who was named Heel because of his action at their birth, and the man who was named Cheater by his twin brother, is now going to get his name changed, and an explanation is going to go with it. His name, according to the man, the God who with whom he has wrestled, is no longer Jacob, but Israel. Now, what does the word Israel mean? According to the story, the name means you have striven with God, and that's the word in Hebrew, sarah, Yisra'el. You have sarad with God, El, and you have prevailed. And so the name change sounds like a true commendation of the man and his willingness to persevere even against God before crossing the river. The same story is given in Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 to 4, in a very brief form, but there the wrestling with God is really a matter of the arrogance of Jacob and not a characteristic to be commended. At any rate, if we again look at what the name actually means, it probably has to do with may God strive or may God prevail. Because usually the name of God or a God is connected to a personal name by way of a verb, and so you get something like may God prevail, may God persevere, but it turns out now to be applied to Israel, the former Jacob, in terms of that you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. And so it's a very commendable thing. It's a very heroic title for him to carry around. The interesting thing is that because Jacob was once the name and Israel is now the name of this person, the two names are really quite interchangeable. And that goes for either the individual, the patriarch, or for the people of Israel, who are very often, particularly in poetry, called Jacob. And so when you hear a story about Jacob, you have to ask, is this really about the patriarch, or is it about the experience of Israel? Or if you hear the word Israel, is it really a story about the patriarch, who is also known as Jacob, or is it about the nation, the people of Israel? It becomes very interesting, actually, in many ways, because when Jacob left on this trip from which he is returning here, he had a dream with a vision of a mound, often translated a ladder in order to fit the song, about angels of God ascending and descending, and Yahweh standing at the top of this mound, introducing Yahweh's self to Jacob, and promising him that he would bring him back to this land. And as a result of that promise, Jacob made a promise of his own, a vow that he would worship God and give a tithe of all that he had. Now, if one thinks about that story and what it might have meant to the people of Israel when they were in exile in the 6th century BC in Babylon, then one would have to say, oh, that's the way God responds to people who are being exiled from their home and going off to another land. God promises to be with them and bring them back. So that must be what we can count on. God will take us back from Babylon to our homeland. Exactly what God said to Jacob, that is Israel, in the story in Genesis 28. So we have to ask even here, is this story somehow a message for later Israel, and not simply a story about the patriarch Jacob Israel? And if it were, then wouldn't it be an encouragement for the people to hang in there, to face difficult times with the perseverance that Jacob showed at the Jabbok River many, many years ago? Well, when we put all that together and then ask, okay, what does this story mean in its context? Now remember again, Jacob had to get out of town because he had cheated his brother Esau twice. His mother said, why don't you go live with my brother, your uncle Laban the Aramean? And for years Jacob was there, and we don't know how many years exactly, but he worked for 7 years and ended up with Leah as his wife, the daughter of Laban. And then it seemed as though he agreed to work another 7 years in order to gain Rachel as his wife. In the process, he managed to have children with the maids of each of these wives, and then with the wives themselves, and he accumulated an enormous amount of Uncle Laban's wealth by some pretty conniving ways. And so he's on his way back now. On his way home, God said, I'll take you home. And here he's going home. But he has to face his brother, who is coming out to meet him with 400 men. That doesn't seem very hospitable. It's got to be really scary for the patriarch. So God wrestles with him here and changes him from Jacob to Israel. The name in ancient times meant a lot, and that's why they tried to explain it so often. The name for us is simply a matter of identification. It's a label we wear. But the name for ancient people actually had more to do with their identity than simply identification. And so the name actually described the person, just as Jacob meant cheater, according to his brother Esau, so Israel meant you've striven with God and prevailed. It says something about the identity of the person, not just a label. Here God is changing the person. He is changing Jacob to Israel before he has to meet this incredible crisis of his life, namely to return to the brother that he cheated twice many years ago. In the process of this change, he does become a different person. When we begin the next chapter, chapter 33, we're told that Jacob looked up and he saw Esau coming, 400 men with him, and he himself went out ahead of his family, bowed down to the ground 7 times, and he came near his brother. He meets him with humility. And Esau ran out to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept together. All that happened, it seems, because God wrestled with him during the night and changed him from cheater to perseverer. And when we put it all in a theological context, we have to say that it all happened because God took this initiative. God came to wrestle with Jacob and allowed him to persevere in the midst of his crisis. That's a powerful story out of a billy goat's gruff tale. Now, speaking of persistence and God's invitation to persistence, let's look at the gospel for the day, Luke 18, verses 1 through 8. My summary of the passage goes like this. Encouraging his disciples to pray constantly and not lose heart, Jesus assured them of God's response to their petitions by telling the parable about the widow who hounded a judge until he vindicated her in a court case. Jesus is still on this fateful journey toward Jerusalem that began, according to Luke, all the way back in chapter 9, verse 51. On the way, Jesus has been preparing his disciples and his adversaries for what would happen. Through his teaching and engaging in dialogue over their questions, Jesus used many parables in this section of Luke's Gospel. In the previous chapter, he dealt with the disciples' request for an increase of faith, healed the 10 lepers, and responded to the Pharisees' question about the timing of the kingdom of God. And now he addresses disciples on the faith-driven life. Our passage begins like this: "And he told them a parable concerning the necessity of praying always." Certainly, one of the major emphases in Luke's Gospel is prayer. Jesus sought temporary solitude on the mountain in order to pray, according to chapter 6, and at the Mount of Olives he prayed that God's will be done in chapter 22. But Jesus did not simply keep this prayer privilege to himself. He really spread it around as much as possible. At the request of the disciples, actually, Jesus taught them to pray in chapter 11, the prayer that included, "Your kingdom come." And so prayer and kingdom are somewhat connected, as they are in our present context. He instructed his disciples in chapter 21 to pray for strength when times of tribulation come, and he commanded them later in chapter 21 to pray that they not enter into temptation, and that's the command he gave the disciples when he went off alone to pray at the Mount of Olives. So there is no uncertainty as to why this parable will be told. It is concerning the necessity of praying always. Now, he said there was a certain judge who is described in not too favorable terms, who neither feared God or had any concern for people. The lack of fear of God and of concern for people reveals the judge as the exact opposite of the two great commandments: "You shall love the Lord your God, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." This man had concern for neither one of them. And this description of the man might certainly be the reason why Jesus refers to him in verse 6 as the judge of unrighteousness. But in a sense now, let's put this in a perspective. The mere fact that the word unrighteous is used of him does not disqualify him from something useful in teaching. We have that same expression in Luke, "the steward of unrighteousness," back in chapter 16, verses 1 to 9, where there is the parable about the dishonest steward. So we have another person who is actually going to be used in a story in spite of the fact that he is called unrighteous or dishonest. But now, with that reputation, there is this widow in that city who kept coming to him. Now, immediately, we have an interesting set of adversaries here: a widow and a judge. Throughout the Old Testament, widows, along with orphans and sojourners, are specifically named again and again as the most vulnerable people, and who by God's command are protected by laws. Yahweh actually executes justice for those people, according to Deuteronomy 10 and many other places. Yahweh forbids lawmakers from perverting justice due to them in Deuteronomy 24. God summons the people of Israel as a whole to advocate in courts of law for the widow and condemns them for failing to do so, according to Isaiah chapter 1. Elsewhere in Luke's Gospel, Jesus condemns the scribes for robbing widows of their houses. That's in chapter 20. And he uses another widow as an example for the disciples, the poor widow, in chapter 21, verses 1 to 4, who put into the temple treasury 2 copper coins. She was commended for her generosity. And so we have these two characters set up: a judge who is unrighteous, that is to say, he doesn't give a hoot for God or for people, and he has this widow, one of the people whom Yahweh protects again and again and again throughout the Old Testament. Now, this woman kept coming to the judge and saying, "Vindicate me against my adversary." Apparently, there was some kind of court case in which she was being robbed, and she was pleading for the judge to execute justice, vindicate. And for a while, he refused. That would be another reason why he would qualify for the title Judge of Unrighteousness. He is not obeying the law of Deuteronomy 24. But eventually this unrighteous judge said, "Though I neither fear God nor regard humans." Now, that's of course a repetition of the way he's already been described by Jesus. And so he admits it himself. "That is, she is just driving me crazy, and the only way I can have any peace at all is to vindicate her." Otherwise, she's going to wear me out by her continual coming and pleading. And Jesus said, listen to what this judge of unrighteousness says. His words are really instructive. He's going to vindicate her because of her persistent pleading. And then Jesus concludes, and will not God vindicate his elect, who cry out to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? He's not going to delay as this unrighteous judge did. God will respond. And indeed, there is set up a comparison, even a contrast, between the judge of unrighteousness on the one hand and God the righteous judge on the other. Jesus' point is simply this. If an unrighteous judge who cares nothing about God or people can vindicate the widow because of her incessant pleading, how much more will the God of righteousness respond to a petitioner's persistent cries for help? After all, Yahweh in the Old Testament consistently proved to be one who hears the cries for help, we call them laments, from the oppressed. The whole Old Testament is full of that, and because of that reputation, Yahweh graciously invited the laments of the widow, the orphan, the sojourner, all the oppressed and afflicted persons. And Jesus now repeats that invitation through the teaching of the parable. Jesus portrays God as one who is willing to hear this persistent pleading. And not only willing, God invites this persistent pleading, and God will respond just as God has been known to respond throughout the whole history of the Scriptures. Jesus then concludes all this by saying, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, that is, when he himself returns in glory, will he find faith on the earth? That is, in spite of the fact that God will vindicate petitioners speedily, will there still be faith? Or are the people going to run off in their own direction? What is faith here? Faith in this passage is described as the trust and confidence that God will respond to prayer. Faith is the willingness to hang in there, to keep crying out for help, as the people of Israel did for so many years in their laments. Keep crying out for help. God will respond. Hang in there. This is probably Luke's address to people of his own time, some 40 to 50 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. They might have been losing faith. They might have been losing the confidence that God responds at all in the midst of everything they're going through. But this parable is meant to encourage them, because God is faithful to prayers, because God does invite cries for help, because God will respond. That is the message for the Christian church, just as surely as God wrestling with Jacob was the answer for Israel in their times of trouble. The second lesson is 2 Timothy chapter 3:14 through 4 verse 5. In times of persecution and stress, the author exhorts his reader, Timothy, to stand firm in the faith he learned from his childhood, from his mother and grandmother, and to regard the written scriptures, the Old Testament, as the source of faith for salvation in Christ Jesus. Whether the author of this epistle was Paul, or more likely an anonymous disciple in the 2nd century A.D., the inspired scriptures mentioned in chapter 3, 15, and 16 can only have been what we call the Old Testament. The New Testament, as we know it and call it, did not yet exist. The writings of Judaism, however, were the Bible of Jesus and the early church, and were considered inspired on the basis of various criteria that developed toward the end of the 1st century AD. They served even early Christians to provide the equipment for every good work, according to chapter 3:17, and to encourage them to be persistent whether the time is favorable or unfavorable, according to chapter 4, verse 2. And so the call for persistence in wrestling with God through constant prayer and in faith is encouraged because God is consistent in answering. That ends our discussion of the passages for lectionary 29, the 21st Sunday after Pentecost, year C. In the next episode, we'll talk about the lessons for Lectionary 30, the 22nd after Pentecost, year C. You will benefit from reading in advance of the podcast the biblical passages for that day. They will be Psalm 84, verses 1 through 7, Jeremiah 14, verses 4 through 7 and 19 through 22 will be the first lesson, and the second lesson will be 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8 and 16 through 18. The gospel for the day will be Luke 18, verses 9 through 14. Be sure to look up the show notes and the accompanying blog at wrestlingwiththeword.com to help you prepare for listening. Before signing off, I want to thank the Cats in the Hats for their music. Their song is their version of Fear Elise. I also express my gratitude to my wife Janine for her very careful editing of the show notes, and I am especially grateful to my daughter Dana Gillen, who serves as my producer for these podcasts. Until next time, the grace of our Lord Jesus be with you.